You're listening to the Right Turn Radio podcast.
So, as part of being responsible citizens in this world, we've decided tonight we're going to do a show. We're going to call it Marijuana 101, which are introduction to marijuana. Because what's happened is that there is so much misinformation about marijuana out there, saying it's, you know, you can go all the way from reefer madness, where it's going to make you a crazy lunatic in 1 second, to it's good for you, it's natural, it's what you're supposed to be doing, it's, you know, part of the way life should be. So we're going to talk about it. We've noticed in our practice it's become much more prevalent, that in the past 5 years, the number of people coming in and smoking it every day has just increased, and people just think it's okay.
And these are mostly young people, would you say?
Yeah, and it's the most widely used illicit substance in the world. You know, people walking around, you know, the common won't be surprised to see that. 42% of Americans say they've tried it. Of those, about 9% use it daily and may be in trouble with it. And we see it probably, you know, mostly 18 to 22-year-olds who use it a lot. And the other thing we've noticed is becoming much more acceptable. You know, I mean, that it used to be considered a bad thing, and now it's just what people do. You know, and people are constantly saying things like, oh my goodness, it's not harmful, it's beneficial. But they're also saying it's better than alcohol. Well, if you had your chance, if you could start the world over and say we're going to legalize one drug, alcohol might not have been the one we legalized. But we don't have that luxury. So, and tonight's show, we have this great guest.
You go ahead and you can introduce the guest. She's sitting right next to you.
And she's lovely. And you should see the evening gown she has on. We have with us Dr. Stacey Gruber, and she's the Director of Cognitive and Clinical Neuroimaging Care at McLean Hospital's Brain Imaging Center. Say that three times fast. And she's an assistant professor of psychiatry at Harvard Medical School. She's led many, many studies about marijuana. We talked to her about a few of them. She knows a lot of the people we know who do research. But one of the ones we're going to talk about tonight is how marijuana use affects executive functioning, the kind of planning part of the brain.
In both adults and teens.
Yes.
And this is the interesting part for me, Abby, is that she studied the impulse control in heavy marijuana users and how marijuana impacted the moods in people with bipolar disorder.
Right. And we've done shows on bipolar disorder.
Right. And you know, we get a lot of people who come in smoking marijuana into our clinic, Right Turn in Arlington, smoking marijuana. And the question is this helping them or is this hurting me? And so welcome, Stacey.
Well, thank you. Thanks
can
very much for
Stacey,
having me.
Can we call you Stacey, Dr.
Please
Gruber?
Do. Please.
So what we really, can you tell us what marijuana is, like what it does to people who smoke?
Sure. So as you appropriately stated, so many people smoke it. It's at an all-time high in high school seniors, which is especially concerning. People are also starting to smoke at earlier and earlier ages when the brain is not yet fully developed. But what happens when you smoke?
Mm-hmm.
So you light up a joint, a spliff, a blunt, depending on your choice, right? Whatever your mode du jour happens to be, you light up.
A bowl, a bong.
We still have those guys coming in. You light up, and what happens? You smoke, and it goes into your lungs. It finds its way into the bloodstream, ultimately finds its way into the brain, where we have these things called cannabinoid receptors.
Right? We have a brain set up to receive these.
We do. We do. And these are specifically CB1 receptors, which are predominant in lots of parts of the brain. So in your frontal cortex, really throughout the brain. So what happens is it binds to these receptors, and you get an effect. You have increases in things like pleasure. You have increases in things like appetite or other drives are increased, if you will. Things suddenly seem a whole lot better for many people who begin to smoke. And it actually takes effect when you smoke it pretty quickly.
You know, Dr. Gruber, a lot of people say that it just helps them chill out. And if they are anxious about anything at all, that a little marijuana helps them.
That's exactly right. So unlike so many drugs, one of the things that actually led me to looking in sort of patients with bipolar disorder and why they may or may not be smoking is that unlike other drugs, people seemed to report this unusual, almost dichotomy of response. If they felt anxious or really, really hyper, they couldn't relax, they'd smoke, they felt calm. If they felt really depressed or down, they'd smoke a little, they felt less sad.
You know, I was a musician for many years. Let me get this out. I was a musician for many years, and I remember marijuana in the 1970s. But the marijuana we have these days is a little different than the marijuana that we had back in 1979.
Yes, I often hear this is not your daddy's marijuana. I hear that all the time. This ain't your grandfather's pot. Right. So the University of Mississippi does these great studies on potency. They seize drugs from all over the country, and they do nothing but sit and assay it and determine what the THC, the active metabolite in marijuana, tetrahydrocannabinol, is. And in the 1970s, it was around 3-3.5% on average. Now, you could get stronger weed back then. You could get hash, you could get sensimilla, you could get all sorts of things. Now, the average is somewhere around 8%. So that's a big difference. And again, hash oil, sensimilla, all these other strains are much, much stronger. So it isn't the same marijuana. It's true.
Is all that done naturally, or do they do synthetic things to them, too?
From what I understand, since I don't have much to do with growing it, there's a fair amount.
Well, you have a lot of experts who come into your office.
They certainly are. They're quite expert at it. This is their bread and butter. They often cross pollinate different species of marijuana, and they breed for high levels of THC, low levels for things like CBD or cannabidiol, which actually doesn't get you high. So there's lots of variation, but as far as I understand, it's fairly natural.
Wait, the way you described it, it sounds so peaceful and pleasant and, you know, oh, everything's great and peachy.
It does.
Are there any problems associated with, I mean, you studied this, so you know there are. Yes. What are the problems associated with smoking pot?
So what we see, especially in individuals who start smoking regularly, so to get into some of our studies, individuals have to smoke a minimum of 5 of 7 days. They have to have smoked 2,500 times in their often young lives, and they have to have positive, their urine has to be positive for urinary cannabinoids. So they have to really be smoking pretty regularly.
They have to have a smoking habit.
They have to have a habit, exactly. And so what do we see in these folks? Specifically in the individuals who start prior to age 16, there seem to be very specific problems, issues, with what we call the executive functions. So these are things controlled by the frontal cortex, the part of your brain right behind your eyebrows that... It's the last to come online and sadly the first to go, and very sensitive to drugs and alcohol during a developmental vulnerability, like during adolescence and emerging adulthood. And what we see is some difficulty with abstraction, regulating impulsive behavior, the ability to inhibit an inappropriate response, difficulty with decision making, things like this, repetitive incorrect responses. They can't really utilize feedback from people.
Can you give some examples?
Sure. So individuals in some of these studies complete lots of neurocognitive tests. These are pencil paper tasks of different types of function. And what we often see is, you know, in one task, for example, subjects have to sort cards given a specific set of rules. And unbeknownst to them, the rule will change. So how quickly they can determine that the rule changed and try something new is what we're looking at. And for the individuals who start smoking early, they have much greater difficulty with this than the adults. And the people who start smoking after age 16, they will put a card down and I'll say, that's incorrect. They'll put a card down that meets for the same exact thing. I'll say, incorrect. They'll do it again, incorrect. These perseverations are repetitive, incorrect responses. They can't utilize feedback to change their behavior.
When I talk to parents, which I do often, I say, you know, it's kind of the part of the brain that it takes the longest, and it's kind of what drives you crazy about adolescence. If that part doesn't develop, the people don't become grown-ups.
That's right. So your ability to plan and, again, make good and sound decisions sort of, you know, on the fly. People used to say things like walking and chewing gum at the same time. It's not quite that simple.
No.
But to do more than one thing at once and to be able really to read your environment and to change your behavior appropriately, if you can't do that, I've talked to lots of parents who say, why can't he just listen what I say the first time?
Because he can't.
Yeah, but Abby, I think a lot of the questions that we get from parents or the concerns are, is this going to have long-term ramifications? Is this going to cause long-term problems? Doctor?
That's a very good question. And longitudinal studies are still a little bit lacking in the literature. We have some very recent data from some longitudinal studies, but they're not quite as thorough or complete as we had hoped they might be. there's an absolute need for this in the fields. We need to look at people long term.
It's one of the things that's been coming up that Sanjay Gupta has put it out there that there's not enough research. But there's not enough research.
No.
So to find out what's going to happen to your kid, does it mean that it just postpones it and they start growing up, you know, when they stop smoking and do they start developing this? And one of the things we talk to parents about is we're really trying to keep the drug use low until they're about 26 or 27 when things are kind of a little more stable in the brain.
Right, right.
And they've learned, you know, how to deal with dramatic situations and how to, you know, deal with feelings and how to plan things. And
it's a great way to put it. You know, you're sort of, quote, under construction while you're 16, 17, 18 years old, even though they think and feel that they're adults. But they're not really able to see sort of the long-term ramifications of doing lots of things. Binge drinking is another issue. You know, they have a hard time understanding that they only drink once a week, but it's 15 drinks.
It's for a weekend.
Right.
I mean, that was Lenny Clark's famous line, right? I only tried cocaine once, but it was for a bunch of years.
For nine years, yeah.
Right. So that's the problem.
Well, question here. Now, a lot of people say marijuana, they said this in the 1970s. I heard it then. That marijuana is the gateway drug. Is there truth to that?
So again, I think there's a lot of controversy regarding the term gateway. And some people feel that gateway is the absolute pathway from a perceived sort of lesser drug like marijuana, even though it's a Schedule I, sort of considered the most harmful, to other drugs like heroin or LSD and other things. There are not a ton of studies to suggest that there's a clear pathway from marijuana use to other illicit substances. Some people might think that marijuana could be a gateway to more positive things if, in fact, medicinal marijuana addresses some of the symptoms that people have been long suffering from.
But is there a risk that marijuana use would affect those neural pathways that might, and I'm sorry, I don't mean to blow this
Absolutely.
Up, but in your opinion?
So long term. I think my answer would be it really depends on how much, how frequently, and at what age you're starting.
Mm-hmm.
And medicinal marijuana use is really in its infancy with regard to research. We don't know much. And so much has to do with the method and mode by which this is delivered, the strength, the potency, the frequency, and how old this individual may be.
Mm-hmm.
Great. We're not going to recommend medical marijuana for everybody early on.
No.
I mean, I think one of the things that people, when they listen to stuff like this, feel like, oh, my, it's, you know, you're just, you know, making a big deal out of nothing. The biggest response I ever get is, oh, you know, it's not a problem. I've been doing it for years. It's not a problem. Maybe the other drugs I'm doing is a problem, but I'm not going to give up my marijuana.
Hey, it's an herb, man.
Yeah, that's right.
It's natural. I hear it's natural. Arsenic is natural, too. I'm not sure I would suggest that.
Doesn't cyanide come from peach pits?
Right,
yeah,
exactly.
Right.
You know, the problem is what you see in these folks, especially, again, the ones who begin smoking earlier. First of all, in our studies, the people who started smoking prior to age 16 smoked 1.5 times as often and 2.5 times as much marijuana per week than those who started later. And maybe that doesn't seem important. But if, in fact, you then realize that marijuana use is related to the type of cognitive or processing issues that these folks have, that is important.
Yeah, that's...
Well, I mean, a drug is a drug is a drug. And we, you know, we see tolerance and sensitivity in any substance use.
Mm-hmm.
So you're saying that marijuana use is just like any other drug, that the marijuana use increases.
Well, so sort of my point is a little bit different from tolerance. It suggests that the people who start smoking earlier smoke more often and smoke higher amounts, not necessarily because of tolerance, because assess specifically for tolerance. It's almost as if it's sort of more habitual for them, and there's not any perceived negative impact from them by and large, so they smoke more often. Most of our guys don't endorse tolerance, actually, surprisingly.
See, that's important to hear.
Yeah.
Impulsivity. You were doing a study on adolescence and impulsivity in pot?
Yes. We look at impulsivity sort of across the board in emerging adults. And what we find is that smokers in general, compared to people who don't smoke, these are very well-matched samples. And I should say this. The people who smoke that we're looking at don't do any other drug. That's really important. And lots of literature out there includes people who smoke, but they also do other substances.
Right, so you're saying just marijuana?
We exclude them if they've tried anything else more than 5 to 10 times in their lives, which is pretty restrictive in the substance abuse literature. So we restrict that. And what we find is, in general, smokers are more impulsive by we use something called the broad impulsivity scale and some other measures, but by self-report, they're more impulsive than people who don't smoke. What we see that's really interesting is in the early onset smokers, people who begin regular smoking prior to age 16, that impulsivity is directly related to a measure of white matter microstructure in the brain.
Okay, but you do, which came first then? The impulsivity, yeah, right.
Very good question. What we see and what we would hypothesize is happening is that earlier onset of use disrupts white matter development because there's also a very clear correlation. The earlier they smoke, the earlier the onset of use, the lower the white matter integrity or coherence, right? White matter is critical for communication from one part of your brain to another. Then we see impulsivity is related to white matter. So earlier onset, lower white matter coherence. Lower white matter coherence, higher impulsivity. So we would suggest that earlier onset of use is disrupting white matter, which makes you a little bit more impulsive. Do we know that for sure?
No.
No.
Yes.
Right. And over what period of time? How much you've been collecting data for how many years?
So we've this is my third large-scale study of marijuana smokers. But importantly, actually, these folks, it's not a longitudinal study. It's all cross-sectional. And what we see, we're really looking at people who are adults. They are typically over 18 when we see them, but they're reporting their use, you know, sort of retrospectively.
Mm-hmm. You mean I started when I was 14? Oh, yeah.
Exactly.
You know, when I talked about doing this show, it's like, well, alcohol is so much worse, and that's fine. But there's also a big talk about, well, it's not addictive. And Woody and I, and I'll assume Stacy also, finds that it is addictive, that people get in trouble with marijuana. I once had a client who he came in. It was just this wonderful, wonderful guy. And he was like, but he would always talk about, well, I've given up this and I've given up that, but I don't want to give up marijuana. I said, well, being someone who's into like giving people options, well, maybe you could smoke just a little. And he's like, I could never smoke just a little. And so he, instead of me convincing him that he had to convince me that he had a problem, and he did. He couldn't. If he smoked a little, he smoked all day, every day. And was he addicted? He couldn't not smoke. And that was, you know, he could not smoke. He missed it terribly. He felt grumpy. His relationship was in trouble because of not smoking, you know, because that's who he was. He was a pot smoker.
But then you have the conversation of the person who comes into your office and says, yeah, man, you know, I don't have a problem with marijuana. And, you know, sometimes when I get a little, like, you know, when I get a little upset or something or a little out of control or angry or something, my friends just say, hey, man, just, you know, chill out, smoke it, you know, take a hit, take a, you know, and chill out. And I do, and I'm okay. So I'm okay. I don't, you know, if I smoke a little bit of weed, I don't get upset.
So, Stacy, have you run into, I mean, do you get a feeling that people are addicted and, I mean, that you've worked with and...
So certainly people can endorse signs and symptoms of what we used to call dependence.
Yeah, and what we're that's now been written out of the dictionary.
That doesn't exist in DSM-5. We now talk about marijuana or cannabis use disorders, and abuse and dependence have been folded together.
So that means it doesn't have to be a physical addiction. It has to be more. It can also be an emotional addiction.
Well, it actually now includes the marijuana withdrawal syndrome.
Okay.
So there's now a recognition of the fact that individuals who smoke regularly can actually undergo physiologic withdrawal syndrome, which people did not endorse often before this. Can people have trouble where they feel addicted? So one of the big differences, I think, in language is going from dependence, which referred to physiologic dependence or physical dependence, to addiction, which really sort of speaks more to the drug-seeking nature, the craving, if you will, the compulsive, I have to get it, I have to get it. So that's a little bit different. Do some people have it? You know, I've heard the number between 9 and 10% meet, quote, criteria for physiologic dependence, and now what we'll term, quote, addiction. In our studies, many of our individuals who smoke 4 to 6, sometimes 8 times a day, do not meet prior DSM-4 criteria for dependence.
Because it requires that it's interfering with your life somehow.
Exactly.
And it's not, because it is their life.
That's right. They don't report any perceived issue in, you know, their social or occupational or educational experiences. It's facilitative for many of them.
Right. I mean, if your friends all smoke pot, your girlfriend smokes pot, you know, and it's what you do in the evening when you watch a movie, then even if you're smoking a lot, and it's not interfering with your life, you can say it's not. You're not in trouble.
Exactly.
So, Woody, you've run into people who decide whether or not to give up pot. How do you talk to them about it?
Well, you know what? I mean, it's interesting because most people that we work with, Abby, are people who come to us with many different substances that they've used. And sometimes they come to us with, they're addicted to some substance like an opiate or alcohol. And, you know, they say, you know, I really want to put down opiates, but I want to hold on to my marijuana mm-hmm. use. And I say, okay, that's an interesting conversation. Let's do that. Let's put down the opiates.
Because that's the most dangerous.
Right. And right but now. Let's talk about the marijuana use. You know, let's do first things first here. But the marijuana use, I really want to ask you, how is it helping you? And, you know, and I think that sometimes, doctor, that we really find that the marijuana use is helping them. And that it kind of goes under that hypothesis of self-medication, that the marijuana is helping them with some type of an underlying issue, whether it's a mental health issue or a psychological mm-hmm. or emotional issue.
Certainly people say that. And in fact, one of the things that we spend a lot of time doing is characterizing our samples for clinical rating scales. So we do a ton of mood rating scales on everybody. You know, one of the things we often hear is, well, it's a healthy control sample. Why do we want to give a depression index? Well, if you don't look, you don't know what the potential difference may be. In fact, at baseline, when we look at our smoking samples, they aren't significantly different from the healthy controls on any measure of anxiety mm-hmm. or depression. We give them state trait measures. We mm-hmm. give them all sorts of measures, positive and negative affect scale, profile of mood states, you name it, we give it. We don't see any huge difference. Does that mean that there's not some underlying other issue that we're not tapping? Perhaps. Mm-hmm. Perhaps. And maybe the marijuana use is actually mitigating those scale scores.
Right. So maybe someone is very anxious and they smoke all the time. They're coming out as like the rest, like the average bear.
Right.
And the verdict may be out how the marijuana is helping them or hurting them. Mm-hmm. But it's it's an interesting piece. Let's go to the phones. We have John on the phone. John, you're live on the air with Woody and Abby.
Hi, Woody. Hi, Abby.
Hi.
I used to smoke pot. I gave it up in 1988. You know, it interfered with my social skills and just my cognitive thinking was messed up. And it had tricyclines in it at the end of my smoking marijuana, and it really is the gateway drug, like Michael Savage used to say. It's a gateway drug to harder drugs. I got started when I was 17 years old, and, you know, I was a heavy pot smoker, and it nearly destroyed my ambitions, motivation, destroyed my dreams.
Did you stop?
Yes, I did.
How'd you do it?
Cold turkey. If there's such thing with marijuana, but yeah. I mean, you know, it was so psychologically addictive that I said, the heck with this. I'm going to be on the straight and narrow because it was illegal. It's
yeah.
legal, and people think it's legal. It's not going to ever be legal in this state, I don't think.
Okay.
It's very expensive, too, John, isn't it?
I'm sorry?
I said it's very expensive, isn't it?
Very expensive. That's why I quit. Another reason why I quit.
Well, thanks. I think I thank you, John, for calling. I think this is, you know, people stop because, I mean, one of the things that worries me is the illegal part. Mm-hmm. I quit because it's illegal. Kids don't feel like it's illegal anymore.
No.
I use the word legalish.
Legalish.
Yeah.
Sort of like a little pregnant. Right. Legalish. Right. So it's decriminalized,
that's
but
right.
It's still not legal. The interesting thing is if there's a great chart from the Monitoring the Future study, which directly relates the perception of risk and harm and use. And as perception of risk and harm drops, use is going up. And
yeah, it's this beautiful.
It's,
oh, that's interesting.
I saw that.
It's really quite compelling. And so all of our discussions and all of our sort of back and forth about legalizing marijuana and the use of medicinal marijuana. So now we have recreational marijuana use that's legal in 2 states, and we have medicinal marijuana use in 20 plus the District of Columbia. So, of course, there's going to be a question. Well, if we're talking about it and it's recreationally acceptable in 2 states, how could it be that risky? How could it be that bad?
Well, it's really interesting because I remember cigarettes are also legal. But this, as cigarette smoking has gone down because it's become less acceptable.
Mm-hmm.
So, I mean, it is possible to change this.
Absolutely.
But I do think this idea of fewer people are going to stop because they're not scared of getting caught. Mm.
Right. I think in the state of Massachusetts, I think you're allowed to, at this point, have up to an ounce. Is that right? Before there are charges brought.
You know, I don't know.
So an ounce is, you know, what, 28.4 grams?
Mm-hmm. And it's like a $100 fine. And
That's pretty benign. So your speeding ticket is going to cost a whole lot more than that.
Have we talked about who's using marijuana? We know that a lot of young people are using marijuana. In your work at McLean, is there a range of ages that you're working with?
We accept individuals from, we have a lower limit of 12, actually, but most of our folks are 17 to 18, and they go all the way up into their sort of mid to late 30s, early 40s.
Oh, really?
But the majority of individuals that we've seen mm-hmm. over the last probably 3.5-4 years are really between 18 and 26,
yep.
which is not surprising given that we're in the greater Boston area and colleges are rife with individuals who are happy to come and sign up for these studies.
Sure.
So,
well, I mean, and do you think that this is you have no idea, I have no idea, but I think that this is becoming, our parents had martinis, I don't know what we had. Just the perfect glass of red wine. Is this kind of the next, you know, is the next generation kind of coming up and this is their recreational drug?
It may very well be. It's certainly clear that the perception of risk and harm, if it continues
that's
to drop,
right.
that and use continues to increase at younger and younger ages. That's the other statistic that's so compelling here. The average age of first use has dropped from just under 18 to a little over 17. Doesn't sound like a lot. That's a whole year in less than 2 years of sampling.
So, and it's a big number, so it's a huge number of kids.
Exactly.
Well, and they talk about that kids, the first time they were offered pot, that's going down significantly, even if they say no.
Right, because more and more people think it's okay to be smoking at 13 or 14. One of the things that we do is we ask them, we sort of call them modified timeline follow-back. I say, tell me about the first time you ever smoked. And they say, well, what do you mean? I say, where were you? With whom? How'd you do it? Where, you know, and they can take you back because everybody remembers exactly when. Now, is that when they first started smoking regularly? It's really important to note first attempt is different from regular use, and that's the big thing.
Let's go to the phone lines. We have Dave on the phones. Yes, Dave, you're live on the air with Abby and Woody.
I'm calling from Western Mass. I'm actually listening to you guys on the internet, and I couldn't help but like overhear your topic. And this is what's going on right now. It's a huge social change. I mean, marijuana has been accepted since the 60s, as being, you know, the next step to, you know, drinking alcohol, for example. I mean, I hear about people wrapping their cars around telephone poles all the time. I'm on a radio show, too. Sure. Anyway, you hear about that all the time. You don't hear about people, like, going out and robbing grocery stores, after they smoke the joint. In fact, they'd probably rather go to, like, you know, a pet store and start petting kittens and going, oh, that's cute. The deal is, I mean, I've been smoking since I've been 13. Obviously, there's exceptions to the rule in your studies about cognitive abilities and being able to function in society and be a social, you know, interacting person. But I just think it's just like having a cocktail. It really is. I mean, it's just, that's the bottom line.
Anyway, I mean, I think that's what we're seeing. I mean, I think we're seeing a change. I think I just think it's not as benign. I mean, alcohol is not benign. It's not as benign as everybody pretends it is. That's all.
Well, Dave, but I also want to say that for some people, it's something that they've used in safety for quite some time. For others, maybe not.
So, I mean, is it something you do all the time?
No, I won't say I do it all the time. I mean, I used to do it all the time when I was younger, but I mean, I don't know, maybe, you know, a couple times a week or something, you know, I'll smoke, you know, a little marijuana and just to kind of mellow me out. I mean, that's really all it is. I mean, it's just like having a martini. It's the same thing. I mean, alcohol is going to mellow you out. Marijuana is going to mellow you out. It just depends on what you want. You want to drink a beer or you want to have a little marijuana?
No, I think you are talking about the change. Stacey?
How much do you smoke in a week?
Oh, gosh. Hardly anything. I mean, really. I mean, maybe, you know, 2 or 3 times a week I'll, you know, spend a couple of bucks. But, you know, nothing huge.
A gram, 2 grams, 6 grams.
No. Probably just a couple of joints.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, so, I mean.
That's about it. I mean, I don't even smoke a whole thing. I'll just smoke a half of it or whatever. Put it out. I'll save it for, you know, another time. You know, I mean, it's not like every.
Well,
time
see, you are the casual pot smoker, and you are exactly who we would not be worrying about.
Oh, okay. Well, I just, you know.
No, but I mean, the idea of leaving it behind a half, you know, half a joint somewhere makes people in this room go, how can you do that? So, I mean, I think that's kind of the difference, right?
Well, plus you said you used to smoke, quote, all the time. How much did you used to smoke when you were young?
Oh, when I was young, I used to smoke every day. I mean, I'll be honest with you, since probably the age of 14, like what your study says. Mm-hmm. And, I mean, obviously, yeah, I was smoking it as, you know, a recreational drug back in the, you know, late 70s.
And you did okay in school? Everything went fine?
Yeah, everything was fine. I mean, I graduated and went on to community college and got a degree in community college and communications and, you know, doing a job and working and being a functioning member of society. I mean, it's just the same thing as if you have two or three cocktails a day. It's the same thing.
So, Dave, thank you for the call.
Years in the Marine Corps. There you go.
Yeah?
I wasn't smoking any marijuana then.
No, I bet you weren't. Thank you, Dave, for that call. I think what I think what that shows is he is the 91%. He's the people who he is. There are a lot of people who've tried pot, who use it occasionally, maybe used to use it more, but decided to stop and stopped. And
the interesting thing is, and I take nothing away from him, I absolutely believe him. You know, everything was great. He graduated from school, went to community college, had a life. My question is, so the people that come into our studies don't report having any problem either, but the individuals who began smoking prior to age 16 certainly look very different from the ones who started smoking later. And it's not that they necessarily perceive themselves as having difficulty. We just see trouble or, sort of alterations, if you will, in these types of cognitive processes. Their brain scans look different. Their white matter microstructure looks a little bit different. Does it have any long-term negative impact? Certainly, if you listen to him, he's okay.
Right. Well, but you're saying memory, things that when you say look differently.
So what we see, the most striking difference really are on these frontal executive functions. So, again, sort of the ability to shift set, the ability to make decisions, the ability to inhibit an inappropriate response in favor of something that's, the appropriate response, they have terrible trouble with. And unless you're looking at it sort of empirically, that is, in a lab doing, or even at home, you know, some of these computerized batteries can do that with studies. Unless you're really assessing that, I'm not sure you'd necessarily know how you did or didn't care.
Well, and how can you know how you would have been if such and such hadn't
exactly.
happened, right?
That's right.
So if you stop, you know, it's he was great. He stopped. He does.
He cut down.
Well, he cut down. Yes, he's cut down. He cut down a lot, it sounds like. So if your brain is, so you have a brain on drugs, and now what's your brain like off drugs? Does it come back?
It's a really, really great question. And actually, some studies suggest that if you're abstinent for even as short as 28 days, a lot of the cognitive differences we see begin to correct. Some of the changes that we've seen in previous studies of regional cerebral blood flow or blood flow through the brain or functional activation look a little bit longer to take sort of back to that normalized route, and we're not really sure of it. The grant that we're doing now is actually funded to study exactly that. It's sort of a message of hope. What does your brain look like after you've stopped using drugs? We're looking for people who are abstinent for a minimum of 2 years.
You know, Dr. Gruber, thank you. And you know what I really like about this, Abby, is that we're having a calm conversation about drug use.
Instead of two people yelling at each other when they agree?
Well, we know that we have this awful epidemic of opiate use in Massachusetts. We know that it's just awful. Yep. We just had this terrible incident with Molly in the press, and continues to play itself out in this kind of circus-like manner. We've had methamphetamine and other substance use going on, but it's so nice that we can actually have an intelligent conversation, and hopefully people that are listening learned a little bit of something about marijuana.
Right, that it's not benign, but it's not, you know, it's not a black and white thing. There may be some benefits of it. There are definitely some side effects of using it that aren't good and aren't what you want in your kid. And it's worth talking about. And if you talk to your, you know, you can't tell your kids that if you smoke pot the first time, you're going to drive your car into a tree. It's not the way conversations happen. You need to have a conversation with your parents about moderation, maybe quitting. If you think you're in trouble, try quitting for 28 days and see if you're any different. And don't trust yourself. Ask someone else if you appear any different.
We've had Dr. Stacy Gruber on our show today. Doctor, thank you so much for coming in.
Thank you for listening to the Right Turn Radio podcast. Please check us out on Facebook and at www.right-turn.org.